the jungles of Africa, or in the wilds of the American frontier. The struggle over whether I should continue at Maine or should quit had become an open battlefield. There was no doubt that my conscience wanted out, but that other side, what I liked to think of as my business school persona, was not so sure. My own empire kept expanding. I added employees, countries, and shares of stock to my various portfolios and to my ego. In addition to the seduction of the money and lifestyle and the adrenaline high of power, I often recalled Claudine warning me that once I was in, I could never get out. Claudine had been right about a great many things. "That was a long time ago," Paula said. "Lives change. Anyway, what difference does it make? You're not happy with yourself. What can anyone do to make things worse than that?" It was a refrain Paula often came back to, and I eventually agreed. I admitted to her and to myself that it was growing more difficult to use the money, adventure, and glamour to justify the turmoil, guilt, and stress. As a main partner, I was becoming wealthy, and I knew that if I stayed longer, I would be permanently trapped. One day, while we were strolling along the beach near the old Spanish fort at Cartagena, a place that had endured countless pirate attacks, Paula hit upon an approach that had not occurred to me. "What if you never say anything about the things you know?" she asked.
"You mean, just keep quiet?"
"Exactly. Don't give them an excuse to come after you. In fact, give them every reason to leave you alone, to not muddy the water." It made a great deal of sense. I wondered why it had never occurred to me before. I would not write books or do anything else to expose the truth as I had come to see it. I would not be a crusader. Instead, I would just be a person, concentrate on enjoying life, travel for pleasure, perhaps even start a family with someone like Paula. I had had enough. I simply wanted out.
"Everything you've learned is a lie," Paula said.
"Your life is a lie." She added, "Have you looked at your own resume recently?"
I admitted that I had not.
"Do," she advised. "I read the Spanish version the other day. If it's anything like the English one, I think you'll find it very interesting."
Chapter 23. The Deceptive Resume.
While I was in Colombia, word arrived that Jack Dauber had retired as Maine's president. As expected, Chairman and CEO Mac Hall appointed Bruno as Dauber's replacement. The phone lines between Boston and Barranquilla went crazy. Everyone predicted that I, too, would soon be promoted. After all, I was one of Bruno's most trusted protégés. These changes and rumors were an added incentive for me to review my own position. While still in Colombia, I followed Paula's advice and read the Spanish version of my resume. It shocked me. Back in Boston, I pulled out both the English original and a November 1978 copy of Main Lines, the corporate magazine. That edition featured me in an article titled, "Specialists Offer Maine's Clients New Services." I once had taken great pride in that resume and that article, and yet now, seeing them as Paula did, I felt a growing sense of anger. The material in these documents represented intentional deceptions. The basic facts were correct, but the important stories behind the facts were omitted, and these documents carried a deeper significance, a reality that reflected our times and reached to the core of our current march to global empire. They epitomized a strategy calculated to convey appearances, to shield an underlying reality. In a strange way, they symbolized the story of my life up to that point, a glossy veneer covering synthetic surfaces. Of course, it did not give me any great comfort to know that I had to take much of the responsibility for what was included in my resume. According to standard operating procedures, I was required to constantly update both a basic resume and a file with pertinent backup information about clients served and the type of work done. If a marketing person or project manager wanted to include me in a proposal or to use my credentials in some other way, he could massage this basic data in a manner that emphasized his particular needs. For instance, he might choose to highlight my experience in the Middle East, or in making presentations before the World Bank and other multinational forums.
Whenever this was done, that person was supposed to get my approval before actually publishing the revised resume. However, since like many other Maine employees, I traveled a great deal, exceptions were frequently made. Thus, the resume that Paula suggested I look at, and its English counterpart, were completely new to me, although the information certainly was included in my file. At first glance, my resume seemed innocent enough. Under experience, it stated that I had been in charge of major projects in the United States, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East, and it provided a laundry list of the types of projects: development planning, economic forecasting, energy demand forecasting, and so on. This section ended by describing my Peace Corps work in Ecuador. However, it omitted any reference to the Peace Corps itself, leaving the impression that I had been the professional manager of a construction materials company instead of a volunteer assisting a small cooperative compromising illiterate Andean peasant brickmakers. Following that was a long list of clients. This list included the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the official name of the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Government of Kuwait, the Iranian Ministry of Energy, the Arabian American Oil Company of Saudi Arabia, Instituto de Recursos Hidráulicos y de Electrificación, Perusahaan Umum Listrik Negara, and many others. But the one that caught my attention was the final entry: U.S. Treasury Department, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Of course it was true, but I was amazed that such a listing had ever made it to print, even though it was obviously part of my file. Setting aside the resume for a moment, I turned to the Mainline's article. I clearly recalled my interview with its author, a very talented and well-intentioned reporter. She had given it to me for my approval before publishing it. I remembered feeling gratified that she had painted such a flattering portrait of me, and I immediately approved it. Once again, the responsibility fell on my shoulders. The article began. Looking over the faces behind the desks, it's easy to tell that economics and regional planning is one of the most recently formed and rapidly growing disciplines at Maine. While several people were influential in getting the economics group started, it basically came about through the efforts of one man, John Perkins, who is now head of the group. Hired as an assistant to the head load forecaster in January 1971, John was one of the few economists working for Maine at the time. For his first assignment, he was sent as part of an 11-man team to do an electricity demand study in Indonesia. The article briefly summarized my previous work history, described how I had spent 3 years in Ecuador, and then continued with the following. It was during this time that John Perkins met Einar Grieve, a former employee. He had since left Maine to become president of the Tucson Gas and Electric Company, who was working in the town of Paute, Ecuador, on a hydroelectric project for Maine. The two became friendly, and through continual correspondence, John was offered a position with Maine. About a year later, John became the head load forecaster and, as the demands from clients and institutions such as the World Bank grew, he realized that more economists were needed at Maine. None of the statements in either document were outright lies. The backup for both documents was on the record, in my file. However, they conveyed a perception that I now found to be twisted and sanitized. And in a culture that worships official documents, they perpetrated something that was even more sinister. Outright lies can be refuted. Documents like those two were impossible to refute because they were based on glimmers of truth, not open deceptions, and because they were produced by a corporation that had earned the trust of other corporations, international banks, and governments. This was especially true of the resume, because it was an official document, as opposed to the article, which was a bylined interview in a magazine. The main logo, appearing on the bottom of the resume and on the covers of all the proposals and reports that resume was likely to grace, carried a lot of weight in the world of international business. It was a seal of authenticity that elicited the same level of confidence as those stamped on diplomas and framed certificates hanging in doctors' and lawyers' offices. These documents portrayed me as a very competent economist, head of a department at a prestigious consulting firm, who was traveling around the globe conducting a broad range of studies that would make the world a more civilized and prosperous place. The deception was not in what was stated, but in what was omitted. If I put on an outsider's hat,
took a purely objective look, I had to admit that those omissions raised many questions. For example, there was no mention of my recruitment by the NSA, or of Einar Greaves' connection with the Army and his role as an NSA liaison. There obviously was no discussion of the fact that I had been under tremendous pressure to produce highly inflated economic forecasts, or that much of my job revolved around arranging huge loans that countries like Indonesia and Panama could never repay. There was no praise for the integrity of my predecessor, Howard Parker, or any acknowledgement that I became the head load forecaster because I was willing to provide the biased studies my bosses wanted, rather than, like Howard, saying what I believed was true, and getting fired as a result. Most puzzling was that final entry, under the list of my clients. U.S. Treasury Department, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I kept returning to that line, and I wondered how people would interpret it. They might well ask what the connection is between the U.S. Department of the Treasury and Saudi Arabia. Perhaps some would take it as a typo, two separate lines erroneously compressed into one. Most readers, though, would never guess the truth, that it had been included for a specific reason. It was there so that those in the inner circle of the world where I operated would understand that I had been part of the team that crafted the deal of the century, the deal that changed the course of world history, but never reached the newspapers. I helped create a covenant that guaranteed continued oil for America, safeguarded the rule of the House of Saud, and assisted in the financing of Osama bin Laden and the protection of international criminals like Uganda's Idi Amin. That single line in my resume spoke to those in the know. It said that Maine's chief economist was a man who could deliver. The final paragraph of the Mainline's article was a personal observation by the author, and it struck a raw nerve. The expansion of economics and regional planning has been fast-paced, yet John feels he has been lucky in that each individual hired has been a hard-working professional. As he spoke to me from across his desk, the interest and support he holds for his staff was evident and admirable. The fact was that I had never thought of myself as a bona fide economist. I had graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration from Boston University, emphasis on marketing. I had always been lousy in mathematics and statistics. At Middlebury College, I had majored in American literature. Writing had come easily to me. My staff as chief economist and as manager of economics and regional planning could not be attributed to my capabilities in either economics or planning. Rather, it was a function of my willingness to provide the types of studies and conclusions my bosses and clients wanted, combined with a natural talent for persuading others through the written and spoken word. In addition, I was clever enough to hire very competent people, many with master's degrees and a couple with PhDs, acquiring a staff who knew a whole lot more about the technicalities of my business than I did. Small wonder that the author of that article concluded that the interest and support he holds for his staff was evident and admirable. I kept these two documents and several other similar ones in the top drawer of my desk, and I returned to them frequently. Afterward, I sometimes found myself outside my office, wandering among the desks of my staff, looking at those men and women who worked for me, and feeling guilty about what I had done to them, and about the role we all played in widening the gap between rich and poor. I thought about the people who starved each day, while my staff and I slept in first-class hotels, ate at the finest restaurants, and built up our financial portfolios. I thought about the fact that people I trained had now joined the ranks of EHMs. I had brought them in. I had recruited them and trained them. But it had not been the same as when I joined. The world had shifted, and what I'd later come to understand as the corporatocracy had progressed. We had gotten better, or more pernicious. The people who worked for me were a different breed from me. There had been no NSA polygraphs or Claudines in their lives. No one had spelled it out for them, what they were expected to do to carry on the mission of global empire. They had never heard the term economic hitman, or even EHM, nor had they been told they were in for life. They simply had learned from my example, and from my system of rewards and punishments. They knew that they were expected to produce the types of studies and results I wanted. Their salaries, their Christmas bonuses, indeed their very jobs,
depended on pleasing me. I, of course, had done everything I could imagine to lighten their burden. I had written papers, given lectures, and taken every possible opportunity to convince them of the importance of optimistic forecasts, of huge loans, of infusions of capital that would spur gross national product growth and make the rich much richer. It had required less than a decade to arrive at this point, where the seduction, the coercion, had taken a much more subtle form, a sort of gentle style of brainwashing. Now these men and women who sat at desks outside my office overlooking Boston's Back Bay were going out into the world to advance the cause of global empire. In a very real sense, I had created them, even as Claudine had created me. But unlike me, they had been kept in the dark. Many nights I lay awake, thinking, fretting about these things. Paula's reference to my resume had opened a Pandora's box, and I often felt jealous of my employees for their naivete. I had intentionally deceived them, and in so doing, I had protected them from their own consciences. They did not have to struggle with the moral issues that haunted me. I also thought a great deal about the idea of integrity in business, about appearances versus reality. Certainly, I told myself, people have deceived each other since the beginning of history. Legend and folklore are full of tales about distorted truths and fraudulent deals. Cheating rug merchants, usurious moneylenders, and tailors willing to convince the emperor that his clothes are invisible only to him. However, much as I wanted to conclude that things were the same as they always had been, that the facade of my main resume and the reality behind it were merely reflections of human nature, I knew in my heart this was not the case. Things had changed. I now understood that we have reached a new level of deception, one that convinces us to do whatever it takes to promote a corrupt system that widens the rich-poor gap through fear, debt, and policies that constantly expand materialist consumption and advocate dividing and conquering anyone who appears to oppose us. These deceptions will lead to our own destruction, not only morally but also physically, as a culture, unless we make significant changes soon. The example of organized crime seemed to offer a metaphor. Mafia bosses often start out as street thugs, but over time, the ones who make it to the top transform their appearance. They take to wearing impeccably tailored suits, owning legitimate businesses, and wrapping themselves in the cloak of upstanding society. They support local charities and are respected by their communities. They are quick to lend money to those in desperate straits. Like the John Perkins in the main resume, these men appear to be model citizens. However, beneath this patina is a trail of blood. When the debtors cannot pay, hitmen move in to demand their pound of flesh. If this is not granted, the jackals close in with baseball bats. Finally, as a last resort, out come the guns. I realized that my gloss as chief economist, head of economics and regional planning, was not the simple deception of a rug dealer, not something of which a buyer can beware. It was part of a sinister system, aimed not at outfoxing an unsuspecting customer, but rather at promoting the most subtle and effective form of imperialism the world has ever known. Every one of the people on my staff also held a title: financial analyst, sociologist, economist, lead economist, econometrician, shadow pricing expert, and so forth. And yet none of those titles indicated that every one of them was, in his or her own unsuspecting way, an EHM, that every one of them was serving the interests of global empire. Nor did the fact of those titles among my staff suggest that we were just the tip of the iceberg. Every major international company, from ones that marketed shoes and sporting goods to those that manufactured heavy equipment, had its own EHM equivalents. The march had begun, and it was rapidly encircling the planet. The hoods had discarded their leather jackets, dressed up in business suits, and taken on an air of respectability. Men and women were descending from corporate headquarters in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, London, Beijing, and Tokyo, streaming across every continent to convince corrupt politicians to allow their countries to be ensnared by the global corporate network, and to induce desperate people to sell their bodies to sweatshops and assembly lines.
It was disturbing to understand that the unspoken details behind the written words of my resume and of that article defined a world of smoke and mirrors, intended to keep us all trapped in a system that is morally repugnant and ultimately self-destructive. By getting me to read between the lines, Paula had nudged me to take one more step along a path that would ultimately transform my life.
Chapter 24. Ecuador's President Battles Big Oil. My work in Colombia and Panama gave me many opportunities to stay in touch with and to visit the first country to be my home away from home. Ecuador had suffered under a long line of dictators and right-wing oligarchies manipulated by U.S. political and commercial interests. In a way, the country was the quintessential banana republic, and corporate giants such as Dole Food Company had made major inroads there. The serious exploitation of oil in the Ecuadorian Amazon basin began in the late 1960s, and it resulted in a buying spree in which the small club of families who ran Ecuador played into the hands of the international banks. They saddled their country with huge amounts of debt, backed by the promise of oil revenues. Roads and industrial parks, hydroelectric dams, transmission and distribution systems, and other power projects sprang up all over the country. International engineering and construction companies struck it rich, once again. One man whose star was rising over this Andean country was the exception to the rule of political corruption and complicity with the corporatocracy. Jaime Roldós was a university professor and attorney in his late 30s, whom I had met on several occasions. He was charismatic and charming. Once I impetuously offered to fly to Quito and provide free consulting services any time he asked. I said it partially in jest, but also because I would gladly have done it on my own vacation time. I liked him, and as I was quick to tell him, was always looking for a good excuse to visit his country. He laughed and offered me a similar deal, saying that whenever I needed to negotiate my oil bill, I could call on him. He had established a reputation as a populist and a nationalist, a person who believed strongly in the rights of the poor and in the responsibility of politicians to use a country's natural resources prudently. When he began campaigning for the presidency in 1978, he captured the attention of his countrymen and of citizens in every nation where foreign interests exploited oil, or where people desired independence from the influences of powerful outside forces. Roldós was the rare modern politician who was not afraid to oppose the status quo. He went after the oil companies and the not-so-subtle system that supported them. For instance, I heard that he accused the Summer Institute of Linguistics, SIL, an evangelical missionary group from the United States, of sinister collusion with the oil companies. I was familiar with SIL missionaries from my Peace Corps days. The organization had entered Ecuador, as it had so many other countries, with the professed goal of studying, recording, and translating indigenous languages. SIL had been working extensively with the Guarani people in the Amazon basin, during the early years of oil exploration, when a disturbing pattern appeared to emerge. Although it might have been a coincidence, and no link was ever proved, stories were told in many Amazonian communities that when seismologists reported to corporate headquarters that a certain region had characteristics indicating a high probability of oil beneath the surface, some SIL members went in and encouraged the indigenous people to move from that land onto missionary reservations. There they would receive free food, shelter, clothes, medical treatment, and missionary-style education. The condition, according to these stories, was that the people had to deed their lands to the oil companies. Rumors abounded that SIL missionaries used an assortment of underhanded techniques to persuade the people to abandon their homes and move to the missions. A frequently repeated story was that they had donated food heavily laced with laxatives, then offered medicines to cure the diarrhea epidemic. Throughout Guarani territory, it was said, SIL airdropped false-bottomed food baskets containing tiny radio transmitters. The rumor was that receivers at highly sophisticated communications stations manned by U.S. military personnel at the army base in the town named after the oil company Shell tuned in to these transmitters. When a member of the community was bitten by a poisonous snake or became seriously ill, an SIL representative arrived with anti-venom or the proper medicines,
often in oil company helicopters. During the early days of oil exploration, five missionaries were found dead with Warani spears protruding from their bodies. Later, the Warani claimed that they did this to send a message to keep missionaries out. The message went unheeded. In fact, it ultimately had the opposite effect. Rachel Saint, the sister of one of the murdered men, toured the United States, appearing on national television in order to raise money and support for SIL and the oil companies, who she claimed were helping the savages become civilized and educated. According to some sources, SIL received funding from the Rockefeller Charities. Family scion John D. Rockefeller had founded Standard Oil, which later divested into the majors, including Chevron, Exxon, and Mobil. Roldós struck me as a man who walked the path blazed by Torrijos. Both stood up to the world's strongest superpower. Torrijos wanted to take back the canal, while Roldós's strongly nationalistic position on oil threatened the world's most influential companies. Like Torrijos, Roldós was not a communist, but instead stood for the right of his country to determine its own destiny. And as they had with Torrijos, pundits predicted that big business and Washington would never tolerate Roldós as president, that if elected, he would meet a fate similar to that of Guatemala's Arbenz or Chile's Allende. It seemed to me that the two men together might spearhead a new movement in Latin American politics, and that this movement might form the foundation of changes that could affect every nation on the planet. These men were not Castros or Gaddafis. They were not associated with Russia or China or, as in Allende's case, the International Socialist Movement. They were popular, intelligent, charismatic leaders who were pragmatic rather than dogmatic. They were nationalistic but not anti-American. If corporatocracy was built by three sectors, major corporations, international banks, and colluding governments, Roldós and Torrijos held out the possibility of removing the element of government collusion. A major part of the Roldós platform was what came to be known as the hydrocarbons policy. This policy was based on the premise that Ecuador's greatest potential resource was petroleum, and that all future exploitation of that resource should be done in a manner that would bring the greatest benefit to the largest percentage of the population. Roldós was a firm believer in the state's obligation to assist the poor and disenfranchised. He expressed hope that the hydrocarbons policy could in fact be used as a vehicle for social reform. He had to walk a fine line, however, because he knew that in Ecuador, as in so many other countries, he could not be elected without the support of at least some of the most influential families, and that even if he should manage to win without them, he would never see his programs implemented without their support. I was personally relieved that Carter was in the White House during this crucial time. Despite pressures from Texaco and other oil interests, Washington stayed pretty much out of the picture. I knew this would not have been the case under most other administrations, Republican or Democrat. More than any other issue, I believe it was the hydrocarbons policy that convinced Ecuadorians to send Jaime Roldós to the presidential palace in Quito, their first democratically elected president after a long line of dictators. He outlined the basis of this policy in his August 10, 1979 inaugural address. "We must take effective measures to defend the energy resources of the nation. The state must maintain the diversification of its exports and not lose its economic independence. Our decisions will be inspired solely by national interests and in the unrestricted defense of our sovereign rights." Once in office, Roldós had to focus on Texaco, because by that time it had become the main player in the oil game. It was an extremely rocky relationship. The oil giant did not trust the new president and did not want to be part of any policy that would set new precedents. It was very aware that such policies might serve as models in other countries. A speech delivered by a key advisor to Roldós, José Carvajal, summed up the new administration's attitude. "If a partner, Texaco, does not want to take risks, to make investments for exploration or to exploit the areas of an oil concession, the other partner has the right to make those investments, and then to take over as the owner. We believe our relations with foreign companies have to be just. We have to be tough in the struggle. We have to be prepared for all kinds of pressures, but we should not display fear or an inferiority complex in negotiating with those foreigners."
On New Year's Day, 1980, I made a resolution. It was the beginning of a new decade. In 28 days, I would turn 35. I resolved that during the next year, I would make a major change in my life and that in the future, I would try to model myself after modern heroes like Jaime Roldós and Omar Torrijos. In addition, something shocking had happened months earlier. From a profitability standpoint, Bruno had been the most successful president in Maine's history. Nonetheless, suddenly and without warning, Mac Hall had fired him.
Chapter 25. I Quit.
Mac Hall's firing of Bruno hit Maine like an earthquake. It caused turmoil and dissension throughout the company. Bruno had his share of enemies, but even some of them were dismayed. To many employees, it was obvious that the motive had been jealousy. During discussions across the lunch table or around the coffee wagon, people often confided that they thought Hall felt threatened by this man who was more than 15 years his junior and who had taken the firm to new levels of profitability. Hall couldn't allow Bruno to go on looking so good, one man said. Hall had to know that it was just a matter of time before Bruno would take over and the old man would be put out to pasture. As if to prove such theories, Hall appointed Paul Priddy as the new president. Paul had been a vice president at Maine for years and was an amiable, nuts-and-bolts engineer. In my opinion, he was also lackluster, a yes-man who would bow to the chairman's whims and would never threaten him with stellar profits. My opinion was shared by many others. For me, Bruno's departure was devastating. He had been a personal mentor and a key factor in our international work. Priddy, on the other hand, had focused on domestic jobs and knew little, if anything, about the true nature of our overseas roles. I had to question where the company would go from here. I called Bruno at his home and found him philosophical. "Well, John, he knew he had no cause," he said of Hall. "So I demanded a very good severance package, and I got it. Mac controls a huge block of voting stock, and once he made his move, there was nothing I could do." Bruno indicated that he was considering several offers of high-level positions at multinational banks that had been our clients. I asked him what he thought I should do. "Keep your eyes open," he advised. "Mac Hall has lost touch with reality, but no one will tell him so, especially not now, after what he did to me." In late March 1980, still smarting from the firing, I took a sailing vacation in the Virgin Islands. Although I did not think about it when I chose the location, I now know that the region's history was a factor in helping me make a decision that would start to fulfill my New Year's resolution. As I sailed up Sir Francis Drake Channel, tacking back and forth into the wind, a wooden boat with a rainbow flag sailed toward me, its sails billowing out on both sides, downwinding through the channel. A half dozen young men and women shouted and waved, hippies in brightly colored sarongs. It was obvious from the boat itself and the look about them that they lived aboard, a communal society, modern pirates, free, uninhibited. I felt a surge of jealousy. I wanted that sort of freedom. And then I understood. My resentment, my anger, was not about my parents. I realized in that moment that my life was a gift from those parents I had so often disparaged. I owed Mom and Dad a great deal for all they'd done to prepare and inspire me to wend my way down the path that had taken me to this moment. I also had to accept personal responsibility for all the mistakes I'd made. Blaming them, as I'd done so many times, was not just foolish and unfair. It was self-defeating. Soon after that, I entered Leinster Bay, nestled into St. John Island, a cove where pirate ships had lain in wait for the gold fleet when it passed through this very body of water. I nudged the anchor over the side. The chain rattled down into the crystal clear water, and the boat drifted to a stop. After settling in, I rowed the dinghy ashore and beached it just below the ruins of an old sugar plantation. I sat there next to the water for a long time, trying not to think, concentrating on emptying myself of all emotion. But it did not work. Late in the afternoon, I struggled up the steep hill and found myself standing on the crumbling walls of this ancient plantation, looking down at my anchored sloop. I watched the sun sink toward the Caribbean. It all seemed very idyllic, yet I knew that the plantation surrounding me had been the scene of untold misery. Hundreds of African slaves had died here, forced at gunpoint to build the stately mansion, to plant and harvest the cane, and to operate the equipment that turned raw sugar into the basic ingredient of rum. The tranquility of the place masked its history of brutality. The sun disappeared behind a mountain-ridged island. A vast magenta arch spread across the sky. The sea began to darken, and I came face to face with the shocking fact that I, too, had been a slaver. That my job at Maine had not been just about using debt to draw poor countries into the global empire. My inflated forecasts were not merely vehicles for assuring that when my country needed oil, we could call in our pound of flesh. And my position as partner was not simply about enhancing the firm's profitability. My job was also about people and their families. People akin to the ones who had died to construct the wall I sat on. People I had exploited. For 10 years, I had been the heir of those earlier slavers. Mine had been a more modern approach, subtler. I never had to see the dying bodies, smell the rotting flesh, or hear the screams of agony. But I too had committed sin, and because I could remove myself from it, because I could cut myself off from the personal aspects, the bodies, the flesh, and the screams, perhaps in the final analysis I was the greater sinner. I turned away from the sea and the bay and the magenta sky. I closed my eyes to the walls that had been built by slaves torn from their African homes. I tried to shut it all out. When I opened my eyes, I was staring at a large gnarled stick, as thick as a baseball bat and twice as long. I leaped up, grabbed the stick, and began slamming it against the stone walls. I beat on those walls until I collapsed from exhaustion. I lay in the grass after that, watching the clouds drift over me. Eventually, I made my way back down to the dinghy. I stood there on the beach, looking out at my sailboat anchored in the azure waters, and I knew what I had to do. I had to take responsibility. I knew that if I ever went back to my former life, to Maine and all it represented, I would be lost forever. The raises, the pensions, the insurance and perks, the equity. The longer I stayed, the more difficult it was to get out. I could continue to beat myself up as I had beat on those stone walls, or I could escape. 2 days later, I returned to Boston. On April 1st, 1980, I walked into Paul Priddy's office and resigned. Part 4, 1981 to 2004. Chapter 26, Ecuador's Presidential Death. Leaving Maine was no easy matter. Paul Priddy refused to believe me. April fools, he winked. I assured him that I was serious, recalling Paula's advice that I should do nothing to antagonize anyone or to give cause for suspicion that I might expose my EHM work. I emphasized that I appreciated everything Maine had done for me, but that I needed to move on. I had always wanted to write about the people that Maine had introduced me to around the world, but nothing political. I said I wanted to freelance for National Geographic and other magazines, and to continue to travel. I declared my loyalty to Maine, and swore that I would sing its praises at every opportunity. At the time, I believed everything I said. I simply wanted out. I wanted to stop being a slaver. Finally, Paul gave in. After that, everyone else tried to talk me out of resigning. I was reminded frequently about how good I had it, and I was even accused of insanity. I came to understand that no one wanted to accept the fact that I was leaving voluntarily, at least in part because it forced them to look at themselves. If I were not crazy for leaving, then they might have to consider their own sanity in staying. It was easier to see me as a person who had departed from his senses. Particularly disturbing were the reactions of my staff. In their eyes, I was deserting them, and there was no strong heir apparent. However, I had made up my mind. After all those years of vacillation, I now was determined to make a clean sweep. Unfortunately, it did not quite work out that way. True, I no longer had a job, but since I had been far from a fully vested partner, the cash out of my stock was not sufficient for retirement. Had I stayed at Maine another few years, I might have become the 40-year-old millionaire I had once envisioned. However, at 35, I had a long way to go to accomplish that objective. It was a cold and dreary April in Boston. Then one day Paul Pretty called and pleaded with me to come to his office. "One of our clients is threatening to drop us," he said. "They hired us because they wanted you to represent them on the expert witness stand." I thought a lot about it. By the time I sat across the desk from Paul, I had made my decision. I named my price, a retainer that was more than 3 times what my main salary had been. To my surprise, he agreed, and that started me on a new career. For the next several years, I was employed as a highly paid expert witness, primarily for U.S. electric utility companies seeking to have new power plants approved for construction by public utilities commissions. One of my clients was the Public Service Company of New Hampshire. My job was to justify, under oath, the economic feasibility of the highly controversial Seabrook nuclear power plant. Although I was no longer directly involved with Latin America, I continued to follow events there. As an expert witness, I had lots of time between appearances on the stand. I kept in touch with Paula and renewed old friendships from my Peace Corps days in Ecuador, a country that had suddenly jumped to center stage in the world of international oil politics. Jaime Roldós was moving forward. He took his campaign promises seriously, and he was launching an all-out attack on the oil companies. He seemed to see clearly the things that many others on both sides of the Panama Canal either missed or chose to ignore. He understood the underlying currents that threatened to turn the world into a global empire and to relegate the citizens of his country to a very minor role, bordering on servitude. As I read the newspaper articles about him, I was impressed not only by his commitment, but also by his ability to perceive the deeper issues. And the deeper issues pointed to the fact that we were entering a new epoch of world politics. In November 1980, Carter lost the U.S. presidential election to Ronald Reagan. The Panama Canal Treaty he had negotiated with Torrijos and the situation in Iran, especially the hostages held at the U.S. Embassy and the failed rescue attempt, were major factors. However, something subtler was also happening. A president whose greatest goal was world peace and who was dedicated to reducing U.S. dependence on oil was replaced by a man who believed that the United States' rightful place was at the top of a world pyramid held up by military muscle, and that controlling oil fields wherever they existed was part of our manifest destiny. A president who installed solar panels on White House roofs was replaced by one who, immediately upon occupying the Oval Office, had them removed. Carter may have been an ineffective politician, but he had a vision for America that was consistent with the one defined in our Declaration of Independence. In retrospect, he now seems naively archaic, a throwback to the ideals that molded this nation and drew so many of our grandparents to her shores. When we compare him to his immediate predecessors and successors, he is an anomaly. His worldview was inconsistent with that of the EHMs. Reagan, on the other hand, was most definitely a global empire builder and a servant of the corporatocracy. At the time of his election, I found it fitting that he was a Hollywood actor, a man who had followed orders passed down from moguls, who knew how to take direction. That would be his signature. He would cater to the men who shuttled back and forth from corporate CEO offices to bank boards and into the halls of government. He would serve the men who appeared to serve him, but who in fact ran the government. Men like Vice President George H.W. Bush, Secretary of State George Shultz, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, Richard Cheney, Richard Helms, and Robert McNamara. He would advocate what those men wanted, an America that controlled the world and all its resources, a world that answered to the commands of that America, a U.S. military that would enforce the rules as they were written by America, and an international trade and banking system that supported America as CEO of the global empire.
As I looked into the future, it seemed we were entering a period that would be very good to the EHMs. It was another twist of fate that I had chosen this moment in history to drop out. The more I reflected on it, however, the better I felt about it. I knew that my timing was right. As for what this meant in the long term, I had no crystal ball. However, I knew from history that empires do not endure, and that the pendulum always swings in both directions. From my perspective, men like Roldós offered hope. I was certain that Ecuador's new president understood many of the subtleties of the current situation. I knew that he had been a Torrijos admirer and had applauded Carter for his courageous stand on the Panama Canal issue. I felt certain that Roldós would not falter. I could only hope that his fortitude would light a candle for the leaders of other countries, who needed the type of inspiration he and Torrijos could provide. Early in 1981, the Roldós administration formally presented his new hydrocarbons law to the Ecuadorian Congress. If implemented, it would reform the country's relationship to oil companies. By many standards, it was considered revolutionary and even radical. It certainly aimed to change the way business was conducted. Its influence would stretch far beyond Ecuador, into much of Latin America, and throughout the world. The oil companies reacted predictably. They pulled out all the stops. Their public relations people went to work to vilify Jaime Roldós, and their lobbyists swept into Quito and Washington, briefcases full of threats and payoffs. They tried to paint the first democratically elected president of Ecuador in modern times as another Castro. But Roldós would not cave in to intimidation. He responded by denouncing the conspiracy between politics and oil, and religion. Although he offered no tangible proof, he openly accused the Summer Institute of Linguistics of colluding with the oil companies, and then, in an extremely bold move, he ordered SIL out of the country. Only weeks after sending his legislative package to Congress, and a couple of days after expelling the SIL missionaries, Roldós warned all foreign interests, including but not limited to oil companies, that unless they implemented plans that would help Ecuador's people, they would be forced to leave his country. He delivered a major speech at the Atahualpa Olympic Stadium in Quito, and then headed off to a small community in southern Ecuador. He died there, in a fiery airplane crash, on May 24, 1981. The world was shocked. Latin Americans were outraged. Newspapers throughout the hemisphere blazed, CIA assassination. In addition to the fact that Washington and the oil companies hated him, many circumstances appear to support these allegations, and such suspicions were heightened as more facts became known. Nothing was ever proven, but eyewitnesses claimed that Roldós, forewarned about an attempt on his life, had taken precautions, including traveling in two airplanes. At the last moment, it was said, one of his security officers had convinced him to board the decoy airplane. It had blown up. Despite world reaction, the news hardly made the U.S. press. Osvaldo Hurtado took over as Ecuador's president. Under his administration, the Summer Institute of Linguistics continued working in Ecuador, and SIL members were granted special visas. By the end of the year, he had launched an ambitious program to increase oil drilling by Texaco and other foreign companies in the Gulf of Guayaquil and the Amazon Basin. Omar Torrijos, in eulogizing Roldós, referred to him as brother. He also confessed to having nightmares about his own assassination. He saw himself dropping from the sky in a gigantic fireball. It was prophetic. Chapter 27. Panama. Another presidential death. I was stunned by Roldós's death. But perhaps I should not have been. I was anything but naive. I knew about Arbenz, Mossadegh, Allende, and about many other people whose names never made the newspapers or history books, but whose lives were destroyed and sometimes cut short because they stood up to the corporatocracy. Nevertheless, I was shocked. It was just so very blatant. I had concluded, after our phenomenal success in Saudi Arabia, that such wantonly overt actions were a thing of the past. I thought the jackals had been relegated to zoos. Now I saw that I was wrong.
I had no doubt that Roldós's death had not been an accident. It had all the markings of a CIA-orchestrated assassination. I also understood that it had been executed so blatantly in order to send a message. The new Reagan administration, complete with its fast-draw Hollywood cowboy image, was the ideal vehicle for delivering such a message. The Jackals were back, and they wanted Omar Torrijos and everyone else who might consider joining an anti-corporatocracy crusade to know it. But Torrijos was not buckling. Like Roldós, he refused to be intimidated. He, too, expelled the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and he adamantly refused to give in to the Reagan administration's demands to renegotiate the Canal Treaty. 2 months after Roldós's death, Omar Torrijos's nightmare came true. He died in a plane crash. It was July 31st, 1981. Latin America and the world reeled. Torrijos was known across the globe. He was respected as the man who had forced the United States to relinquish the Panama Canal to its rightful owners, and who continued to stand up to Ronald Reagan. He was a champion of human rights, the head of state who had opened his arms to refugees across the political spectrum, including the Shah of Iran. He was a charismatic voice for social justice who, many believed, would be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Now he was dead. CIA assassination once again headlined articles and editorials. Graham Greene began his book Getting to Know the General, the one that grew out of the trip when I met him at the Hotel Panama, with the following paragraph. In August 1981, my bag was packed for my fifth visit to Panama when the news came to me over the telephone of the death of General Omar Torrijos Herrera, my friend and host. The small plane in which he was flying to a house which he owned at Cuclecito in the mountains of Panama had crashed, and there were no survivors. A few days later, the voice of his security guard, Sergeant Shushu, alias José de Jesús Martínez, ex-professor of Marxist philosophy at Panama University, professor of mathematics and a poet, told me, "There was a bomb in that plane. I know there was a bomb in the plane. But I can't tell you why over the telephone." People everywhere mourned the death of this man who had earned a reputation as defender of the poor and defenseless, and they clamored for Washington to open investigations into CIA activities. However, this was not about to happen. There were men who hated Torrijos, and the list included people with immense power. Before his death, he was openly loathed by President Reagan, Vice President Bush, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as by the CEOs of many powerful corporations. The military chiefs were especially incensed by provisions in the Torrijos-Carter Treaty that forced them to close the School of the Americas and the Southern Command's Tropical Warfare Center. The chiefs thus had a serious problem. Either they had to figure out some way to get around the new treaty, or they needed to find another country that would be willing to harbor these facilities, an unlikely prospect in the closing decades of the 20th century. Of course, there was also another option. Dispose of Torrijos and renegotiate the treaty with his successor. Among Torrijos's corporate enemies were the huge multinationals. Most had close ties to U.S. politicians and were involved in exploiting Latin American labor forces and natural resources, oil, lumber, tin, copper, bauxite, and agricultural lands. They included manufacturing firms, communications companies, shipping and transportation conglomerates, and engineering and other technologically oriented corporations. The Bechtel Group was a prime example of the cozy relationship between private companies and the U.S. government. I knew Bechtel well. We at Maine often worked closely with the company, and its chief architect became a close personal friend. Bechtel was the United States' most influential engineering and construction company. Its president and senior officers included George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger, who despised Torrijos because he brazenly courted a Japanese plan to replace Panama's existing canal with a new, more efficient one. Such a move not only would transfer ownership from the United States to Panama, but would also exclude Bechtel from participating in the most exciting and potentially lucrative engineering project of the century. Torrijos stood up to these men, and he did so with grace, charm, and a wonderful sense of humor.
Now he was dead, and he had been replaced by a dictator who referred to himself as the maximum leader of national liberation, Manuel Noriega, a man who lacked Torrijos's wit, charm, and intelligence, and a man who many suspected had no chance against the Reagans, Bushes, and Bechtels of the world. I was personally devastated by the tragedy. I spent many hours reflecting on my conversations with Torrijos. Late one night, I sat for a long time staring at his photo in a magazine, and recalling my first night in Panama, riding in a cab through the rain, stopping before his gigantic billboard picture. Omar's ideal is freedom. The missile is not invented that can kill an ideal. The memory of that inscription sent a shudder through me, even as it had on that stormy night. I could not have known, back then, that Torrijos would collaborate with Carter to return the Panama Canal to the people who rightfully deserved to own it, or that this victory, along with his attempts to reconcile differences between Latin American socialists and the dictators, would so infuriate the Reagan-Bush administration that it would seek to assassinate him. I could not have known that on another dark night he would be killed during a routine flight in his twin otter, or that most of the world outside the United States would have no doubt that Torrijos's death at the age of 52 was just one more in a series of CIA assassinations. Had Torrijos lived, he undoubtedly would have sought to quell the growing violence that has plagued so many Central and South American nations. Based on his record, we can assume that he would have tried to work out an arrangement to mitigate International Oil Company destruction of the Amazon regions of Ecuador, Brazil, Colombia, and Peru. One result of such action would have been the alleviation of the terrible conflicts that Washington refers to as terrorist and drug wars, but which Torrijos would have seen as actions taken by desperate people to protect their families and homes. Most important, I feel certain that he would have been served as a role model for a new generation of leaders in the Americas, Africa, and Asia, something the CIA, the NSA, and EHMs could not allow. Chapter 28. My Energy Company, Enron, and George W. Bush. At the time of Torrijos's death, I had not seen Paula for several months. I was dating other women, including Winifred Grant, a young environmental planner I had met at Maine, whose father happened to be chief architect at Bechtel. Paula was dating a Colombian journalist, but we remained friends. I struggled with my job as an expert witness, particularly in justifying the Seabrook nuclear power plant. It often seemed as though I had sold out again, slipping back into an old role simply for the sake of money. Winifred was an immense support to me during this period. She was an avowed environmentalist, yet she understood the practical necessities of providing ever-increasing amounts of electricity. She had grown up in the Berkeley area of San Francisco's East Bay, and had graduated from UC Berkeley. She was a free thinker whose views on life contrasted with those of my puritanical parents and of Anne. Our relationship developed. Winifred took a leave of absence from Maine, and together we sailed my boat down the Atlantic coast toward Florida. We took our time, frequently leaving the boat in different ports so I could fly off to provide expert witness testimony. Eventually, we sailed into West Palm Beach, Florida, and rented an apartment. We married, and our daughter, Jessica, was born on May 17, 1982. I was 36, considerably older than all the other men who hung out in Lamaze class. Part of my job on the Seabrook case was to convince the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission that nuclear power was the best and most economical choice for generating electricity in the state. Ironically, the longer I studied the issue, the more I began to doubt the validity of my own arguments. The literature was constantly changing at that time, reflecting a growth in research, and the evidence increasingly indicated that many alternative forms of energy were technically superior and more economical than nuclear power. The balance also was beginning to shift away from the old theory that nuclear power was safe. Serious questions were being raised about the integrity of backup systems, the training of operators, the human tendency to make mistakes, equipment fatigue, and the inadequacy of nuclear waste disposal. I personally became uncomfortable with the position I was expected to take, was paid to take, under oath in what amounted to a court of law.
At the same time, I was becoming convinced that some of the emerging technologies offered electricity-generating methods that could actually help the environment. This was particularly true in the area of generating electricity from substances.